Welcome to the deep dive. I mean, what if the ultimate life hack for maximizing your own joy is just completely ignoring it?
Right, which sounds completely backwards to us today.
Exactly, because today we spend billions trying to optimize our happiness. You download the meditation apps, you refine the morning routine, you drink the green smoothies.
And you relentlessly protect your peace.
Yeah, protect your peace at all costs. It's like modern culture treats joy as this engineering problem.
Yeah.
You can just solve it by focusing inward and looking out for number one.
But honestly, that is just a deeply exhausting way to live. I mean, the sheer amount of effort required to constantly monitor and manufacture your own happiness, it's one of the primary drivers of the burnout we see everywhere
No,
today.
absolutely. And that actually brings us to our mission for this deep dive,
Yeah.
because today we're looking at a 2,000-year-old letter that claims our modern obsession with ourselves is, well, it's basically a psychological black hole.
It really is a completely different paradigm.
Right. So we are analyzing Dr. Matthew S. Harmon's work on this tiny, incredibly dense, four-verse section of the Book of Philippians, specifically chapter 2, verses 1 through 4.
Yeah, it's this ancient, highly countercultural formula for maximizing joy.
So to start us off, where exactly are we in the text?
Well, to set the stage properly, Dr. Harmon identifies this specific passage as a structural bridge in the letter.
A bridge between what?
So the author Paul has just finished a section arguing that his readers should live as citizens of a heavenly kingdom, that this identity should act as the constitution for their daily lives.
Okay, got it.
And then immediately after our passage, the text launches into the famous Christ hymn, which is this poetic breakdown of the radical mindset of Jesus.
Right, that's a super famous section.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But right here in the middle lies the blueprint. It is the practical mechanics of how community, humility, and joy actually intersect.
Okay, so my joy account is supposedly funded by this heavenly citizenship. But what does that actually mean? To understand how this works, we really have to look at the unique architecture of the text itself.
Right. Yeah, because Harmon points out that this isn't just like a bulleted list of nice spiritual ideas.
Right.
What's fascinating here is the sheer grammatical force of the original Greek. Philippians 2.1 to 4 is a single continuous flow of thought. It's one massive sentence.
Wait, really? The whole thing?
Yeah, the whole thing. I mean, English translators break it up into readable chunks for us, but originally it operates as an intricate if-then statement. And Dr. Harmon zeroes in on the fact that this is a first-class conditional clause.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because a first-class conditional sounds like something you need a frequent flyer mile account for.
Right, yeah.
But it actually fundamentally changes the entire meaning of the passage, doesn't it?
No, it changes everything. Because in Greek grammar, a first-class conditional means the if portion is not hypothetical at all.
So it's not like saying, if it happens to rain tomorrow.
Exactly. It is a rhetorical device where the premise is assumed to be 100% true for the sake of the argument. You could legitimately just translate it as since.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So when the text says, if there is any encouragement in Christ, it literally means since there is encouragement in Christ, and we all absolutely know that there is.
So it's not wishful thinking, it's a certainty. And Harmon lays out the four specific benefits of the gospel that are embedded in this non-hypothetical if statement.
Right, the four
Yeah.
realities.
First, there's encouragement in Christ, which is described as this internal and external emboldening. Second is comfort from love, like an ultimate divine consolation. Third is participation in the Spirit. And fourth is affection and sympathy, which he describes as a deep impulse of tangible concern for others.
We really need to slow down on that third one, though, participation in the spirit, because it is so easy to read that as just, mystical
Yeah,
jargon.
it sounds a bit abstract.
But in the first century Roman world, society was brutally stratified. I mean, you had patricians, plebeians, freedmen, and slaves.
Massive inequality.
Huge. And you had massive ethnic divides between Jews and Gentiles. So the idea of fellowship or participation across those lines was practically unheard of.
Right.
Yet in these early house churches, you had wealthy merchants sitting right next to enslaved people, sharing a meal as equals.
Wow.
So that participation in the spirit was a literal, explosive sociological reality.
That's incredible context. And Harmon also unearths this hidden Trinitarian structure beneath those first three benefits, right?
Yes, he does.
You have encouragement in Christ, comfort from love, which historically points back to God the Father as the source and participation in the Spirit.
And that underlying structure is so crucial. It means this framework isn't just some psychological trick, By anchoring these benefits in the Father, Son, and Spirit, the text is saying that your foundation for joy is rooted in the ultimate reality of the universe.
It's as solid as it gets. I like to think about it like checking your bank account before a massive life-altering purchase.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, because with the first-class conditional, you aren't logging into the banking app, crossing your fingers, and just hoping the funds miraculously appear.
Right, you're not guessing.
Exactly. The funds, the encouragement, the comfort, the radical fellowship, they've already cleared. The capital is sitting in the bank. It's a guaranteed foundation.
Which naturally begs the question of the then clause. The capital is there. The theological account is fully funded.
Right.
So what is Paul asking these people to actually do with that capital?
Yeah, what's the withdrawal strategy?
Yeah.
Verse 2 hits us with the central command of the entire passage. Complete my joy.
Complete my joy.
And Harmon clarifies that the author isn't saying, you know, I'm miserable, please make me happy.
Mm.
He already possesses joy. He is commanding them to take it to its absolute limit, to fill it to the brim.
And Harmon explicitly uses this verse to dismantle what he calls the cosmic killjoy myth.
The cosmic killjoy, yeah.
Because modern culture often views ancient religion, and Christianity in particular, as this austere, grim system of just rule-keeping.
Yeah, no fun allowed.
Right. But this text actually commands the pursuit of joy. We are fundamentally wired to seek happiness. The theological argument isn't that desiring joy is bad. It's that our targeting systems are broken. We look for it in places that can never sustain it.
But wait, I have to push back a little on this concept of commanded joy. I mean, can you really mandate an emotion?
It's a fair question.
If I'm having a terrible week and someone comes up to me and tells me to cheer up and find my joy, my immediate instinct is to throw my coffee at them.
Yeah, please don't do that.
I won't. But isn't commanding someone to be joyful like forcing someone to laugh at a terrible joke? It usually produces the exact opposite effect.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we really have to recognize that our modern definition of joy is drastically different from the ancient one used here.
Oh, so?
Well, we equate joy with a fleeting, circumstantial emotion, like a dopamine hit because traffic was light or you got a promotion.
Right, something that happens to you.
Exactly. But in this text, joy is an orientation of the heart. Notice that Harmon points out this joy is inextricably linked to having the same mind.
The same mind. Which, I have to say, sounds dangerously close to a hive mind. Mm-hmm. Are they supposed to agree on every single minor detail of daily life?
No, not a hive mind at all. It's a shared fundamental framework. It means possessing a single-minded focus on the implications of the gospel.
Okay, so it's about the core values.
Right. When a community shares the same values, the same ultimate beliefs, and relies on that same bank account of grace you mentioned, it creates a profound security. Joy is just the byproduct of that deep, unified reality.
So it's not dependent on how your day is going.
No, you can experience this kind of joy even while you're grieving or suffering, because it isn't dependent on your immediate circumstances. It's dependent on your shared foundation.
Okay, so if we are naturally wired for this kind of joy, but our targeting systems are broken, like you said earlier, where exactly are we getting it wrong?
The text doesn't leave the diagnosis ambiguous. It goes straight for the jugular in verse 3.
It directly attacks the default human operating system.
Oh, absolutely.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Verse 3 says, "Do nothing from selfish ambition." Harmon highlights that the King James translation uses a spectacular, highly specific word for this. Vainglory.
Vainglory. The Greek word is kenodoxia. It is a literal compound of the words for empty and glory.
Empty glory. Which perfectly describes the modern impulse to analyze every situation by asking, how does this benefit me? How does this elevate my personal brand, my status, or, you know, my peace of mind?
This raises an important question about how the original first century audience would have heard this command. Because to really grasp the weight of rejecting vainglory, you have to understand the Greco-Roman culture of Philippi.
What was it like?
Well, Philippi was a Roman colony, essentially a miniature Rome. And in that society, humility was not a virtue.
It was a liability.
It was viewed as a pathetic weakness. You can look at philosophers like Aristotle, who praised the megalopsuches, the magnanimous man.
The magnanimous man, yeah.
This ideal man was someone who claimed great honors for himself and despised being outdone by anyone else. Roman society ran on the concept of dignitas, your personal clout and reputation.
Right. It was all about status.
Entirely. It also ran on a brutal patron-client system where relationships were completely transactional based on who owed whom a favor.
So you climb the social ladder by stepping on necks. Showing weakness or actively lowering your status to serve someone beneath you was essentially social suicide.
Precisely. So when early Christians started radically elevating humility, when Paul tells them in this letter to count others as more significant than yourselves, they were completely upending the foundational values of Western civilization.
That's huge.
They took a concept that society considered a humiliating weakness and crowned it as the ultimate strength.
It is a staggering paradox. Society, both 2 millennia ago and today, screams at you to fiercely protect your own interests. If you want to be happy, guard your boundaries, optimize your own life.
Right. Look out for number one.
Exactly. But this text argues that radical self-denying, others-focused humility is the actual mechanism for joy. The vainglory of self-promotion is just a black hole. It will never fill you up. Pouring yourself out for others is what fills the joy tank to the brim.
Because you were designed to function that way. It's the teleological argument. Like, a hammer finds its joy in driving nails, not in sitting on a velvet cushion.
That's a great analogy.
We find our joy in reflecting the self-giving nature of the God who designed us.
So what does this all mean when we drag it out of the realm of theory and into, say, a Tuesday afternoon?
The messy reality, right?
Yeah. It sounds lovely and poetic to talk about pouring ourselves out for others. But if you're listening to this and thinking about a specific coworker or a neighbor or of a family member who is just entirely toxic and unlovable, applying this gets really messy.
I'm sure everyone listening has a specific face popping into their mind right now.
Oh, for sure. And when you see that face, you feel absolutely zero Christ-like love. Your blood pressure spikes. The modern psychological advice is usually to cut that toxic person out of your life to protect your peace.
Set those boundaries, yeah.
Right. So if you take Harmon's advice instead and you act nicely, put their interests first and serve them, aren't you just faking it? Isn't forcing behavior that contradicts your internal emotions exactly what we hate about modern, superficial corporate culture? It just feels like peak hypocrisy.
That is a very fair modern critique, but it fundamentally misunderstands the mechanics of ancient virtue formation.
Okay, how so?
Harmon makes a crucial point here. Waiting until you feel like obeying is unbiblical. There is no asterisk in Philippians 2 that says, count others more significant than yourselves unless they are really annoying or dismissive.
So you just grit your teeth and repress your resentment.
Yeah.
Because suppressing negative emotions usually just leads to them exploding later.
Well, it isn't about repression. It's about the mechanics of transformation. Harmon points out that you must make a conscious choice of the will to act in self-sacrificial love, even when the feelings are entirely absent.
Interesting.
You are not faking it to deceive them. You are acting in faith to train your own heart. Historically, theologians and even modern neuroscientists agree on this. Actions reshape the affections. Habituation creates virtue.
So the action precedes the emotion.
Yes. You don't wait for the feeling of love to generate the action of service. You initiate the action of service because it is right, and the feeling of love often follows in its wake.
Wow.
Doing the physical act of putting someone else first begins to break down the hardened cynicism in your own chest. It's a rigorous discipline.
And that circles us all the way back to the bank account analogy, to that first-class conditional. You don't have to generate the love out of your own empty emotional reserves because you just don't have any left for this difficult person.
Right, you're bankrupt there.
Exactly. Instead, you're pulling from the comfort from love and the participation in the spirit that are already guaranteed to you. You withdraw those funds and you spend them on the unlovable coworker.
You maximize your joy by reflecting on the guaranteed benefits of your foundation, and then you spend them. You pursue unity through countercultural, self-sacrificial service. That is the withdrawal strategy.
Let's summarize the architecture of this for everyone listening. The core takeaway from Dr. Harmon's analysis of these four verses is a complete reversal of our modern instincts.
A total reversal.
You don't find joy by looking inward and obsessing over your own fulfillment. You maximize your joy by looking outward. You reflect on the guaranteed foundation you already possess, and you choose radical, costly humility.
And Harmon leaves us with a highly specific practical challenge based on this text. He challenges the reader to identify just one tangible act of self-sacrificial love that they can execute for someone else this week.
Just one act. But it can't just be a polite thought, right?
No, it has to cost you something real. It must cost you actual time, actual energy, or actual money to be a blessing to someone else.
Right.
It doesn't need to be a massive cinematic gesture that everyone sees. In fact, it's probably better if no one sees it. But it must be an intentional act of the will where you explicitly place another person's interests above your own.
That takes the theology out of the clouds and forces it right into your daily schedule.
It certainly does.
As you figure out what that one act of service is going to be this week, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Think back to that Greco-Roman world we discussed earlier, the world of Aristotle and the magnanimous man. To them, humility was a pathetic, humiliating weakness.
It was culturally despised.
But today, largely because of the historical paradigm shift sparked by texts exactly like Philippians 2, our culture at least pretends to value humility. Even if we're terrible at practicing it, we recognize it as a virtue.
Yeah, we know it's good in theory.
Exactly. So here's the provocative question. Consider all the virtues of our modern hyper-individualistic hustle culture. The endless self-promotion on LinkedIn, the constant optimization of, number one, the life hacks we use to isolate ourselves and protect our peace.
Mm-hmm.
What if people 2,000 years from now look back at our culture and realize that all those things we chase so desperately to avoid burnout were actually just completely empty vainglory?
Wow. That is a perspective-shifting thought to carry into your week.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Go spend some of that guaranteed joy.